Hello and welcome to the First Take Film Club podcast. I'm your host, Liam Jones, and this week we are covering the Oscar-winning black comedy feminist revenge thriller, Promising Young Woman. We cannot wait to get stuck into this, but before we do, let me introduce my two boss co-hosts, Connor Norcott and Luke Chanley. Connor, how are you, mate?
You know what? I'm really good. We were chatting a little bit before we started recording, and I was saying that I've been doing all this voiceover for this uni project I'm doing, and I feel like I'm all talked out. So maybe if the listeners don't enjoy my voice, this will be a nice week for you. You've hit jackpot. Here you go. Apart from that, honestly, I'm pretty good. I'm all coffeed up, just out of the shower, so I still feel a bit soggy, but we move, as the kids say.
Soggy is not a word to describe how you feel when you get out of the shower. Not soggy.
Damp at best. Refreshed. Damp at best.
Soggy or moist should not be any words used to describe how you are when you get out of the shower, to be honest. Anyway, Luke, how are you, mate?
Yeah, good. I'm not moist. I'm not damp. I'm not soggy. I am dry as dry comes. Good. Just trying to think of something interesting to say, but I don't really have anything. And like, not because I'm all talked out, because Connor was saying, oh, I'm all talked out, so I haven't got much on. And I was thinking, oh God, I'm not even talked out and I haven't got much to say. So yeah, I'm fine. I'm aching all over because I've started a PT this week just to try and remove some of the excess lockdown weight. And I'm aching quite strongly. So it doesn't stop me from talking, but it definitely stops me from moving quicker than, quicker than I usually walk. I don't know what I'm trying to say. it is clearly affecting me speaking. So yeah. How are you, Liam?
I'm good, mate. I'm a lot better than you following your PT. Feels like it's written you off. I was saying off air that I had something similar last week. It wasn't with a PT. It was with my cousin, and he worked me a little bit too hard. It was a whole week ago and I'm still sore. But today I'm great. I've got a busy day ahead doing bits and bobs and whatever. And then as of tomorrow, I've got a really, really, really busy time at work, which, you know, just got to do. And you just got to do it. Get on with it. Get the paycheck. Mo money, mo problems, as as whoever said it said, I guess. I don't know who it was. It's probably a rapper, maybe 50 Cent. I don't know.
I don't think anyway. It was 50 Cent, but I don't know who it was either.
Somewhere between 50 Cent and Nick Knowles, I've heard.
yeah. Oh, no, 50 Cent is Get Rich or Die Trying. That's where I'm getting confused. Anyways, that's enough about how we are. Let's move on to our opening question. And with the interesting soundtrack of Promising Young Woman, I want to revisit a past question that we've asked on the podcast before. So what I want to know, boys, is what are some of your favorite movie soundtracks? Connor, I'm going to go to you first because you've already told me that your answer is probably going to be the same as the last time. So remind the listeners in case they forgot, your answer is...
It has to be Trainspotting, doesn't it? I think it has. I don't know. I feel like the whole like wave of 90s UK music that kind of came back around still hasn't died off yet. And everyone still listens to some of the bangers and some of the sad songs that are also on that soundtrack as well. But I do have an honourable mention, and it's only because I was listening to it in the shower today. For some reason it came. I just hit play on Spotify and there must be like 10,000 songs that I've liked. And there's a song from Django Unchained that Rick Ross is on called like 10,000 Coffins. And I thought, oh man, this is great. I want to watch Django again. And because of that reason alone, I'm going to say Django's got a pretty boss soundtrack. It would be my little sleeper hit on that. How about you, boys?
Luke, how about you, mate?
I have, the first one that came to my mind is Baby Driver, because that's just got an absolutely amazing soundtrack. And then also like honourable mention. Well, I'd say there's joint. I think Lion King has got a great soundtrack. And I think Baby Driver has. And like an honourable mention for Drive, which is just like a lot of, like I only really, I think we're talking off air, like I only really recognise two of the songs to be able to like go and find and play it on Spotify. But like all the way through, it just sounds great. So I'll put that in there as an honourable mention.
I think last time I mentioned the Black Panther soundtrack, which is produced by Kendrick Lamar, and I love it. It's something that I revisit frequently. It's probably the only movie soundtrack that I revisit a lot. It's just full of bops, full of like real good tunes, and quite different as well. Quite different tracks on that album as well. Pulp Fiction is another one, which is like one of those. Oh, obviously, Pulp Fiction. It's just, it's fun and playful, isn't it? And it kind of, I don't know, it gets me in a good mood. It gets me in a good mood. I want to just name a couple of soundtracks that, actually, I say Black Panther. There's one that I listen to a lot, but only when I'm with my girlfriend, and it's the Greatest Showman soundtrack. It's good. Connor rolls his eyes. I say do one, because it's actually... it's great. It's great. The songs are fun. The songs are fun and they're catchy. There's one track that when me and Laura are drunk, we actually get up and do the dance to. It's called Home Again or something like that, I think. I say do the dance to, I mean attempt to do the dance to. If you actually watch on like TikTok, they do, it's like quite a famous TikTok thing for them to do the dance in the street to this one particular song, and it's hard. So when I say do it, I attempt it. Another one, Mamma Mia. I love that film, and who doesn't love ABBA? Do you know what I mean? Who doesn't love ABBA?
ABBA have got so many smash hits, man.
They're just full of bangers. And you know, Pierce Brosnan singing SOS. What more do you want? What more do you want? James Bond singing SOS, for me, that's up there with the best of the best, the greats. Anywho.
Can I give one final honorable mention?
Go on then.
And it only reminded me when you said Black Panther. Spider-Verse has got an absolutely incredible soundtrack. It like, really like does, as so. In, like, if that was like, as to, well, obviously you can't buy it, but like, if that just came out as an album, it'd be an absolute fly. So that's my, that's my last one that reminded me when you said Black Panther.
Yeah.
I've got another honorable mention, sorry.
Go on.
And once again, I'm bringing it up. I've maybe brought it up about a month ago on the podcast. There's a really boss couple songs in Ocean's 12, which is really, everyone hates that film. But I'm telling you, there's this like kind of really catchy little Italian song at the closing. And I've got it saved in one of my Spotify playlists called Pretentious. And I'm a big fan of that song. So yeah.
Connor, Pretentious.
No.
Oh, you're describing someone else, mate. You're describing someone else.
No.
That's not you.
That never describes a man who's got a picture of 2001 Space Odyssey behind him as we record.
Yeah. That's Connor all over, isn't it?
Is this the roast of Connor Norcott today? Fucking hell, what's going on?
Yeah. And in case you've forgotten where he's from, he's also got a sign with his hometown on it behind him as well. Ballycastle.
Marlon Brando as
and
well.
Marlon Brando with a cat. But it looks like a fox. Is it a cat? I know he has a...
Yeah, I think it's meant to be a cat, but it's...
It would be absolutely mental if it was a fox.
It would be. No, it would be. Some good answers there, boys, to be fair. I was quite impressed with that. You know, I mean, Connor, you kind of gave the same answer as last time and then added in another mention later on. But, you know, good answers from me and Luke, nonetheless. Let's move on to the main event. We are tackling the Oscar-winning Promising Young Woman. So it took home maybe 2 weeks ago now, the best original screenplay. Emerald Fennell took that home. And, you know, we'll get into it, whether maybe it was deserved or not. I personally think it probably was. So it's directed by Emerald Fennell, written by Emerald Fennell. It's a really interesting film. I'm just going to get into the plot very quickly, and then we'll get into our first takes of this film. So after losing her best friend in a mysterious tragedy, Cassie has put her career aspirations on ice. Instead, she spends her nights drawing in sexual predators by pretending to be drunk and then dispensing her own form of justice. So the premise is makes the film seem very interesting, and maybe obviously it is a revenge thriller, a feminist revenge thriller, you could say. So First of all, I want to know your first takes. So, Connor, I'm going to throw it to you first, mate. What was your first take of Promising Young Woman?
You know, the first thing I remember, like when the credits rolled over, I was a bit like, I felt a bit confused. And it wasn't because I didn't understand the tone of the film or what the messages were, or even like on a literal sense, what happens in the film. I kind of just didn't know what to make of it. And I think we'll touch on it a little bit later. But for me, I think it tries to do a lot of things at the same time, and they kind of muddle over each other at times. And some of the points are a bit nebulous. Apart from that, I think it is an important and fucking ridiculously engaging film with probably one of the most hard to watch scenes I've had to watch in quite a while. And you know what, man? I think it's thoroughly recommendable. I would recommend it to anyone. And you know what? In relation to the Oscars that you touched on, I think what taking home the prize that it did is thoroughly justified, because not enough debut filmmakers make risks and take risks, like Emerald Fennell did. And yeah, big up.
Big up indeed. Luke, what was your first take, mate?
Quite literally, mate, it was fucking amazing. I think I wrote on my Twitter straight afterwards, because it was like, I think probably watched this about a week ago. And I would have liked to watch it again, but I just haven't been able to get around to it. That I thought it was like, it was definitely the best film I've seen since before COVID, which probably isn't like that much of a thing really. But, you know, even before that, I can't necessarily remember something that I seen new. That was what Connor said was, bob on about it just being like ridiculously engaging. Like, it didn't take, like, obviously we've seen the trailers and we've heard the hype, and we all kind of, I imagine before we watched it, kind of knew what we were about to watch in terms of like it being challenging in a number of ways. But what it does really well is actually it is challenging, but it is engaging too. And that's actually, it's probably pretty rare really. Because I don't think the subject matter is quite deep, and I think we'll probably touch on it, but not necessarily labour on it, because we're probably not the right people to. But you know, a film that does touch on such deep topics could easily be mired in quite dark roots, really. Like, it could feel quite heavy, and after it did feel heavy, but not in like such like a necessarily depressing way. And I think what does that is like some of the soundtrack and the visuals and stuff like that. But I think it toes that line really well between like saying a thing that it wanted to say, doing some surprising elements, especially towards the end, but also just being super engaging. And I just thought like all those came together. I think I agree with Connor a little bit as well in that there was something like tonally. I think tonally, as you're going through the film, it's slightly confusing, but kind of when you come to the end, it all kind of makes sense. But it's just some of the risks that are taken in tone are like a little bit confusing. But man, I loved it so much. Just thought it was absolutely brilliant.
Yeah, I think so. So first of all, my first take, and I can only really go off my initial thought as soon as the film ended, and I was left feeling slightly cold. Only because the direction the film chooses to go is somewhere that I didn't expect it to. And I suppose in some senses, it was actually quite a brave decision to use that as the ending. You know, I think we're all aware with cases like that anyway, there is, you know, oftentimes a woman would end up dead. So I think to actually, Fennell in this film subverts a lot. Sometimes she's almost, maybe there's too much subversion in some instances. She plays with a lot of different genres within this film. You know, there are segments of this film that are literally straight up rom-com, you know, whilst Cassie and Ryan are dancing to a song by Paris Hilton, you know, there's this like 2-minute segment where it is full on kind of rom-com, you know, that you would see in, I don't know, some flick with Matthew McConaughey and I don't know, something like that. Do you know what I mean? It was very rom-commy. But then I think what that does is when you have the kind of the more impactful and serious and quite heavy moments, I think it does give it that, it makes it feel a lot weightier. Because in contrast to like this moment you just had before, and then touching on what you said, Luke, with kind of the bright colors, you know, and the kind of floral like outfits that Cassie wears, and she's got her like bright colored nails and bright blonde hair, and she kind of is she kind of embodies femininity, but then also, you know, her mannerisms when she is taking out kind of her revenge on these sexual predators is almost quite, she's dominant and powerful in some of the scenes. So yeah, basically my first take, I kind of went way off skew there, didn't I? But it's because there is so much in this film. My first take, my initial thought was I was left feeling cold. I enjoyed the film, but I was left feeling cold. However, I watched the film again last night and I enjoyed it way more. I think when you know what's going to happen, I feel like it's easier to enjoy. And maybe enjoy isn't the right word, because the last 15 minutes is not enjoyable at all. But there is playful elements of it. And so I think there is elements of this to be enjoyed by, which we'll touch on later. But yeah, I did really like this film. And then on second watch, I really, really liked this film. So let's actually get into some of the plot. I want to touch on the opening because, well, the initial opening is, for me, it was quite funny. You've got Charlie XCX's boys playing while these like gross white guys in suits are like gyrating on this like quite empty, well-lit dance floor, which kind of, that's it. That's, you kind of know what movie you're in almost from that point, because they're, you know, the depiction of these gross men just looking like idiots. I think you kind of know the direction the film's going to go in. And then we're quickly met, introduced to Cassie, and very quickly introduced to her revenge technique. Connor, I want to throw to you, what did you think about like this kind of opening, and you know how quickly we're thrown into kind of Cassie's life and what she does, you know, on these weekends where she lures these sex predators and makes them pay for their actions?
I think I was initially kind of confused, because confusion runs deep for this film for me. Maybe that's just where I am at the minute and all this other nonsense I've got going on. I had some, you know, preconceptions of what this film was going to be going in, and I thought that it would kind of be a bit more, let's not say horror vibes, but almost like thriller slasher, like there would be, she would kill these people. And I think initially am really glad now that that's not what I, you know, played out, because it's kind of less about, well, at least at times I think it's less about revenge for revenge sake and more of kind of like a lesson to be learned thing. And I think I can't remember which one of you said it, but the consistent subversion and kind of twist and what your expectations are going to be is something that I actually fully enjoyed about this film, coming from like a filmmaking standpoint. You're consistently kind of wrong-footed and taken a different way than you think you're going to go. And even from the opening, like, First of all, I didn't know it was a Charlie XCX song, but that's kind of cool. But when you see the quote-unquote ritual of what she does, and it's kind of changed each time as it goes on, I think that's when you're kind of dealing with a filmmaker who knows her craft already. And that's why, honestly, like, there's so much for me that I want to praise about this film in terms of quality of filmmaking. And from that moment and how it kind of transitions onto the other little rituals that we'll talk about is something I really enjoyed.
So Luke, I'll kind of elaborate on that a little bit. And I want to ask you about the actors used to portray these the nice guy, the gentleman who turns into the sexual predator. So we've got Adam Brody, who is, you know, he usually plays like the teen heartthrob, and you've got Christopher Mintz-Plasse, who, you know, we all know from Superbad and Kick-Ass, you know, he's like a lovable, like funny guy, bit of an idiot. So what I want to ask to you is, how did that impact on you, you know, with the choice of actor, you know, and even Ryan is, you know, played by Bo Burnham, who is, you know, a comedian turned director, you know, it's likable guys, I guess.
When we do this podcast, sometimes like someone will raise a point that you're about to make and you're like, oh, well now if I agree, it just seems like I'm just agreeing. But like I wrote down in my notes, like I noticed it the other day, how like the actors are kind of like your traditional like nice guys. But also I think the point is on that, they are nice guys, but actually if you go back and rewatch The OC, Seth Cohen is a bit of a creep. If you go back and watch Superbad, Fogel is a bit of a creep. So actually, I was about to say McLovin, and I don't know why I said Fogel. I've never called him Fogel ever. Honestly, I don't know what I'm doing. But like, he's actually a bit of a creep. And what is really cool is, I suppose, like, this is where like you've given me like 1 + 1, and I've maybe come to 2 or possibly come to 5. But like, they've clearly gone, can we get nice guys who have just been creeps in films a bit? Because like when I was younger, I loved Seth Cohen, but when you look back, like it's a bit of an odd dude, really. But it's a cool little thing, and like I like stuff like that, and it's all like a little nod and a wink to like different things, and that's probably what this film does quite well. Like what you said with Bo Burnham is exactly right. Like, you know, he is quite a likable guy, and he, even in this film, you know, up until, I don't know how long the film is. Is it what, just shy of 2 hours? Even, you know, you're talking up until an hour and a half. You don't think he isn't a nice guy in the film, and that's not to say whether, you know, personal judgments on what's actually happening. But at a point in the timeline of the film, he isn't a good dude. So it's all just like subversion and like twisting things slightly on the head. Yeah. Even up, you know, and we're only talking about the beginning of the film, but like even at the end, things get twisted on the head, which we'll come to later, so I don't want to talk about. But I just think it was really cool choice of like casting for those actors in particular.
Yeah. Staying on kind of the opening, because I think it really does set the film up for kind of how it carries on to play out. But the moment that Cassie snaps out of her drunken phase, when she is about to be, you know, sexually abused, and she snaps out and she sits up and she speaks with this really deep, you know, sobering kind of like authoritative, quite intimidating voice, you know, and it is quite, and the score as well is almost played for in a kind of horror type way. For me, it was really affecting, you know, I thought, why, you know, I thought, to be honest, I thought she was going to end up killing him, and then I thought that was going to be the film. We have the funny scene while she's, you know, following that, while she's eating a bacon bap or whatever, and she's covered in ketchup. But, you know, initially you think, oh, shit, is it blood? You know, and I think, like, that's fun and playful, and that's where Fennell has kind of, you know, sought to intrigue the audience, you know, by kind of subverting this and, you know, kind of throwing misdirections here and there. But, Connor, about... with that kind of initial moment where Cassie snaps out of her like drunken phase, and that, you know, that is how she catches these predators kind of in their way, you know, whatever they're doing. And then she subsequently adds their names to like a little pink book, and, you know, the amount of names in the book just from the start, you know, it's quite staggering. And she's obviously been doing this for a long time. So kind of, what are your opinions on what she is doing? You know, and obviously why, you know, with her friends and what happened to her.
I think it's one of those things where I wasn't entirely sure once again where the film was going to take us. So even up until then, like you mentioned, you're still kind of questioning whether or not it's blood on her arm when she's walking away from either a potential murder or a potential lesson given to someone who's a bit of a fucking wrongin'. But I wondered if you'd see an almost escalation in her let's in her interventions with these people. And I wondered if it would lead to someone being killed. And little did I expect that it would play out the way it did. When I saw the little pink book, though, I wondered, this is when I thought, like, oh, this must be like a kind of slashery killer film. And I kind of didn't expect the turns that it was ready to take. And I don't know, there's a lot of points I want to make off of this that'll come up later, because I think logistically there's a kind of quite a lot of flaws in this film, and it doesn't have to be entirely logistical. This film is one thing and one thing only, because it's far from that. I think when you start to look at Cassie as a character, kind of some of it doesn't, like some of the kind of planning doesn't really come together as well as you think it does. And there are moments where everything plays off without a hitch, and I think it's in the agenda, Liam, and we will touch on it soon, like the kidnapping that happens halfway through the film. And there's a scene with Alfred Molina, who played the lawyer who defended one of the rapists that she later comes to have an altercation with. And I just kind of wondered if, once again, maybe there's just a little bit too much happening, and maybe because there's such an overwhelming grief and anger and kind of pain that Cassie's went through because of what happened to Nina, her friend, that's almost kind of the point of the film, that there is almost, it's so overwhelming that a lot of it can kind of be buried. But my main thing here is that's only there if you think that way, and it's never really spelled out. And like we talked on maybe two episodes ago, you shouldn't have to dumb down your content for your audience, but it does need a little bit more of an explanation, I think, sometimes. And I think it did for me here.
So Fennell has actually spoken about her choices, and she did say that she was going to have a scene or maybe multiple scenes insinuating or even depicting Cassie being abused by some other men when she, seeks out her act of vengeance, which maybe in a sense would be more realistic. You know, if there are hundreds of men that she has, tried to catch in the act or whatever, mm-hmm. You would imagine there would be, they're wrong-uns anyway. So you would imagine that at least some of them would be, go to the point of maybe assaulting her once she does come around out of her faux drunken phase. Mm-hmm. So that was something that Fennell did want to add into the film, but I think she chose not to in the end. I'm not sure why, maybe to keep, I don't know, to maybe to simplify what she was doing. So then, because otherwise I think as a viewer, we're there sitting really worrying and overthinking every time she does this, rather than what it kind of portrays in the film before the final act, that kind of every time she does it, it's kind of a success. She succeeds in humiliating these predators, and kind of maybe she's also succeeded in them reevaluating their choices, and they might not do this again. Mm-hmm. But ultimately as well, I think on her, on her little quest, I think she's kind of seeking validation, not for herself, but validation for what happened to her friend, because no one is willing to really own up to it or admit their wrongdoings. Yeah. And I think all she really ever wants is someone to claim accountability for what happened, which is kind of why the end is a little bit fuzzy for some, because accountability ultimately might not happen the way that, it's portrayed in the end with the police coming, which we will touch on later. Let's move on to the character of Ryan. So he's introduced as the love interest and maybe the guy that can take Cassie out of this revenge-driven kind of phase. I guess it's more than a phase. It's been going on for years. He isn't aware of it. But I think there is one telling point right at the start when they first meet that kind of suggests that he may be a bit of a wrong-un anyway. And that's that she spits in his drink and he just looks her right in the eyes and takes a sip. And I don't know, I didn't really think of it anything of it the first time around. I just thought, he's trying to get a date with an attractive woman, you know, he's kind of just being playful, whatever. But like second time round, when you know what he does in the end, or what he doesn't do, maybe is the better words to use. It's kind of, it makes me feel gross that he's done that. I don't know. And then, you know, they'd have their first date and he tries to take her to his flat. You know, he's presumptuous and, you know, she clearly doesn't like that. And I don't know, he makes a couple of mistakes anyway. Luke, I want to know what you think of the character of Ryan. You know, do you think that it made sense where he ended up in the film?
I don't know if made sense is the right thing, because it doesn't make sense, but not, that doesn't mean it's wrong. You're just like, that's where the shock factor comes in. So when you, like, the thing that you said about the spit in the cup, I just like completely forgot. And then he obviously drinks it, which is like grim. Like at the time, I do remember thinking like, what odd thing to not necessarily do, because it is odd to do, but then like people do odd things and you don't have to include them in a film. So like, you know, and every minute includes something that is relevant usually in a film. So I was a bit like, oh, that's a bit odd. But then maybe, I don't know, man. And you know, you never know with films that tackle topics that are quite serious, whether actually you're digging into them and actually know that's just a thing that happens. But whether, you know, you may know, I'd like to watch it again because there may be things, and that's the whole point, where they seem relatively normal, like not normal, but relatively straightforward when you watch them. But knowing what you know at the end, there's lots of things that hint at the thing that happens at the end. And maybe that's like a storytelling thing to tell a point about this subject matter, where there's always maybe little telltale signs. And that's one of the things where like, it's an idea and it could easily be, you're just seeing things that aren't there. But with Ryan's actual character, no, I don't think it necessarily made sense, but it was good though, what happened, I think, in the film in relation to, obviously Ryan turns out to be in a video that Cassie sees of an assault taking place, and he's not, I don't know if he's actually egging it on, but he's not discouraging it or even voicing any kind of opinions, which obviously is a bad thing. But I did think that was a really cool, that's where the rom-com element of the middle third makes more sense more sense as a storytelling thing, in my opinion, because I just love the way that it just flips it totally on its head. But then it goes from one extreme, actually that kind of does make sense. It goes from quite grim to very rom-com, but then it flips it back on its head to the other extreme where it then turns into something else. So like, I think his badness doesn't make sense until it does make sense, and then it all kind of makes sense, if that makes sense.
Yeah. So there is there's something I asked my girlfriend just for some opinions on this film. We watched it together the first time, and what she said to me was actually quite interesting. So she said, obviously, you know, ultimately the kind of rape culture is horrible. You know, she spoke about going out and, you know, a guy will just hit on her, or maybe like I've been there, literally stood next to her where a guy has maybe like grabbed her bum or something really inappropriate, you know, which happens to a lot of girls. I would say nearly every girl it would happen to. So she spoke about that quite candidly, and I guess it's something that nearly every woman does go through, which is kind of then makes the film more impactful, I guess. You know, what she does by going out, you know, at night of the weekends, yeah, she's actually willfully, you know, doing this to lure these guys in. But, you know, this happens. You know, this happens to girls that aren't willfully letting it happen, mm-hmm. You know, and another thing that she said to me, though, which is I guess it's contrasting. Maybe not so, but she said that she didn't actually like the fact that all men in this film were depicted as, I guess, quote unquote, wrong'uns or kind of bad dudes, or maybe ultimately in the end, not great. I suppose the only man in this film that we don't see or hear about doing anything wrong is Cassie's father, who is just like an all round nice guy. But yeah, that's just something I've read other articles as well, kind of that do touch on that. But then I listened to the Empire podcast, and their editor Terry White is a real lover of this film, and she spoke about, you know, the depiction of men in this film and the fact that most men in this are, I guess, not very nice guys. But the fact of the matter is what she says is it's not for, you know, they're not trying to say that all men are bad. What they're trying to say is all men are capable of overpowering a woman if they wanted to. You know, most men are stronger than most women is what she said. And I guess that's a contrasting point whereby Fennell, I guess, is trying to show that all men are capable rather than all men will actually act this way. I think that's just like two interesting differing opinions. Connor, I'll throw it to you, mate.
There's a line near the end of this film that I genuinely like. I must have watched it about 10 days ago, knowing that it was kind of one that we were talking about for the podcast, and we had some messages asking us if we'd cover it, so that was also really nice. But there was a line near the end of this film that I'm going to absolutely bastardize because I can't remember it now. Mm-hmm. Off the top of my head and completely verbatim. But it was essentially about the when Cassie does confront Nina's rapist and kind of has him chained to the bed and is ready to scribe Nina's name on his stomach, or carve it, I should say, in his stomach. I find it really interesting that the way she described it as the kind of her, like his name was all over her, that it was completely dominant, and that's kind of something that she had to live with forever. And when you look at the way that women are spoken to, especially Cassie, are spoken to in this film by men, not just men, but by men, it's always really, you know, aggressive, kind of over the top, really horrible verbal language. And I wondered if that's kind of something to do with that, where it is kind of like Terry White talks about, who on all of her film criticism I love, it is kind of that overpowering, domineering, kind of making you feel small and pathetic and worthless, kind of, that's the kind of tone they were going for. And if that's the case, it worked to a fucking T.
Yeah, I tell you what, I think the writing is concise and it is brilliant. And then there's one moment on the second watch that stood out to me, and it's directly connected to what you just said, Connor. And it's when Ryan is in bed with Cassie and he's telling her that he loves her. But within that, just before it, he goes, "Oh, shut up, you fucking bitch." And yeah, it's yes, playful, yes, and he's joking.
Yes, 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 yes.
He's joking, but he literally, if you take it, what he says is, mm-hmm, you know, "Shut up, you fucking bitch." You know, I wouldn't say that to my girlfriend, even if I was joking. So I guess I know some people have different relationships and you can kind of be playful like that. I understand that. But when you learn to understand what he, you know, goes on to do in the end of the film, I think it's quite telling. And, you know, just a general depiction of men in this film anyway, it's quite interesting that, mm-hmm, even it's a moment he is telling his girlfriend that he loves her and he still calls her a fucking bitch.
Yeah, like, that's interesting.
That in itself says it all for me, really, about just the actions of some men.
In the, I think, can I just, it probably has relevance, but let's just talk about it anyway. So what you say there, what I touched slightly on before, but maybe didn't quite understand what I was saying at the time, is, you know, when I talk about like things seem normal until it add up to a thing that isn't good, and then you look back and the things that are happening are bad, like with the spit and like with the calling your partner a fucking bitch. Obviously they're not good, but in isolation they can be explained away, I suppose, is the thing. And what I want to compare that to is something that, like, I won't take long, and it's not to do with the film, but you know when the stories about Louis C.K. being a wrong'un came out, and obviously he was accused of a lot of things, and none of them were good. Mm-hmm. And I think I don't think you say it's proven, but it's proven basically that what he did. What I find really interesting is that the approach that the thing that I took from that whole situation was actually the reason, not disappointed me so much, but the thing that shook me was actually, so he did this one act, but then if you actually take his actual act and his livelihood, is these jokes that are out of context, really bad. Like, there's a lot of really, really crude and quite dark jokes in there, but like, they are jokes, and that's his shtick. And the reason you could get on board with those jokes and that shtick is because you understood that he was joking. Like, you 100% believed he was joking from a lot of the personality that he portrayed outside of his comedy and stuff. So you took that all as fine. But then when that came out, I've never revisited his stand-up, but you start rethinking about his stand-up and the things he said that you once explained away in isolation, makes it really, really uncomfortable to even ever, even if this all comes out to be a lie, go back and think, oh, that's okay, because that was just a joke, because you no longer trust the thing to be a joke. So when we were talking about like almost like a timeline of things which are explainable away, it just reminded me of how I felt when the accusations came out about Louis C.K. and then looking back at the things he'd said, even if you take them in or out of context, that were all really bad, and you go, I can't explain that away in good conscience anymore. And there's no real, like, I'm not comparing the situations, are just reminding me of it, really.
Yeah, I think there's a parallel there for sure. Yeah.
Sadly, in real life now, there are lots of instances of that, which is it's quite shocking, to be honest. What I want to ask you guys is about Cassie's actions as the film develops, and do we think she oversteps the mark? She, I would say, not quite kidnaps, but she insinuates a kidnapping of the dean of the university, her daughter. And what's also interesting, I might add, is Fennell makes sure to include women who are, I would say, complicit in the wrongful doings of, or maybe the basically the dean is essentially trying to help Al Munro get away with what he'd done, because there's not enough evidence, or, oh, we don't want to ruin a promising young man's life, you know, which kind of, I think it's interesting. I don't know if you guys know with the Brock Turner case from about four or five years ago, he was, he assaulted, I think it was more than one. I think it was multiple women on university campuses in America. And he got let off. One thing, his father wrote a letter to the court and said, oh, you're going to ruin this my son's life for 20 minutes of action, which is disgusting. And can you believe anyone would ever say that? And then the judge, when giving him a lighter sentence, described him as a promising young man, you know, which is, you know, it says it all. And I think, I don't know if maybe that's the reason this film's called Promising Young Woman, but it's clever either way. Sorry, I got sidetracked. But going back to, do we think Cassie ever overstepped the mark? Luke, do you think she ever overstepped the mark with the dean's daughter? And then with a potential hit on Jordan, the lawyer as well, Alfred Molina's character, you know, I think she meets a guy outside afterwards, and there is potentially a hitman. He is potentially a hitman about to do a hit. What are your opinions on that?
I actually think if you just like, so I, with Connor, so I, it makes sense when I get to the end. When Connor said before, I thought it was going to have more of a horror element, and I thought she would have she was going to murder people. That's what I thought the film was going to be. Taking that into account, whether that happens or not, which it doesn't. You can rarely look at a film and go, that's taken too, sorry, you can really look at a film and say that hasn't taken a thing too far. So, like, let's take, you know, you could watch you mentioned Django before. You can watch Django. There's probably loads of things that go too, not too far, but could be said go too far. And I'm just picking random films. So I'll, in front of me, I've got Frozen. There's probably something there where you go, that's absolutely mad. That wouldn't happen. So if I take the idea that I thought this was a horror film, well, every horror film you look at has got people, literally probably all men, something going too far. So the idea of going too far, well, maybe, probably, but the rules of the game, if it was the guy doing this, are the fact that it's never really too far. So what I'd kind of say is, like, in the film, no, I never at a point was like, oh, that's too far. I just kind of took it in a way as like accepting that this is standard fare for many films, and she was just a woman in the lead role doing these things. So I don't think she took them too far. Obviously, you could get into it, and I kind of don't really want to, of whether each situation is too far for that person, given that they may be making either honest mistakes or just naive mistakes. Let's take the principal, for example, but there's probably others that I can't think of. But I generally just, I didn't think at any point that anything was too far. I kind of just, to be honest with you, this is quite bad. A lot of things I was just like, fuck me, that's like awesome. Like, kind of quite exciting and thrilling and interesting. So that, I suppose, no, I don't think it was too far, but for loads of different reasons that are both within film genres and just in general.
I think the big thing for me, right, is, and I talked about at the top of the show, that how I kind of really struggle to contextualize this film because, like I said, it's commenting on so much that sometimes I thought at least some of those points were blunted a little bit. But the one thing that really stood out for me was the kind of inbuilt, innate commentary on revenge. And there is a trend in, like, you know, rape revenge exploitation films that dates back to like the exploitation era of the 80s. If you look at something like Miss 45 or I Spit on Your Grave, I think it's called. I remember doing a module on this. Even if you look at a film that came out recently that, Liam, I know you put me onto and gave me heavy, heavy warnings, The Nightingale, you could classify that as like a rape revenge thriller almost. When you look at this, though, the commentary itself is kind of on the revenge, at least for me, and how that kind of overshadows Cassie's life and the kind of lingering trauma and effect that can have on someone, and that it never fucking leaves them. And that's where I think this is like almost really masterful writing. And when you look at, you know, we're using this question, did she go too far, as kind of a point to make a bigger point here. You can't really go too far, as Luke talked about, because it's within the confines of the film. But in terms of her character arc, I guess you could kind of say it led to her own downfall. And that poses a bigger question as whether that was always going to happen or not. But what's really interesting to me is that in this film, it poses that, first of all, her life is overcome by revenge and trying to figure out whether, you know, she can actually attain this and what it'll mean for her and, you know, the respect, hopefully, that Nina's life will have gained from that. But also, while it shows that that doesn't work, you kind of need it, because it kind of, the whole point of the film, at least for me, up until about an hour and 40 in before the final 5 minutes, was that the systems in place don't give a flying fuck about justice and what the real justice and the real truth, what the outcome of that should be. So she has to take matters in her own hands. And that's where the film is, works and works and works up until the last 5 minutes. And I thought, I don't get this now.
I listened to a podcast last night called Promising Young Podcast. It's you know, a little mini podcast about the film. And what the women on the podcast, what they spoke about is how Cassie becomes a hero and a villain at the same time. You know, she's, I guess, to the viewer, she's a hero, but I guess even maybe to herself, she's the villain in the, does she oversteps the marks? Maybe does she? Yeah, you know, that's open for debate, but she does things that do maybe make her, well, she maybe goes to the point of no return. And I guess that's the kind of the villainous aspect of it, in a sense, is that she goes so far that, you know, there maybe is no redemption anymore. Interestingly, though, regarding her actions, I read an article on RogerEbert.com, or Roger Ebert, sorry if I pronounced that incorrectly. It's by a journalist called Mary Beth McAndrews. And at the beginning of the article, she explains that she herself is a victim of sexual abuse. And she explains how it made her feel, like this film. And one of the main things she talks about is that that consent in this film doesn't go further than consent during sex. And what she makes a point about is that Cassie can't consent with her friend Nina about her actions, you know, but she does talk to Nina's mum, who tells her to stop, you know, and move on almost. Mm. And I guess for Mary Beth McAndrews, she's kind of suggesting that she doesn't consent her friend. Obviously, she can't consent her friend, but surely this isn't what her friend would have wanted.
Yeah.
It's obviously insinuated that that Nina takes her own life following her rape. So I guess Cassie's taking it upon herself, and she's maybe, I don't know, is she overstepping the mark to take revenge for a friend who, you know, didn't say whether or not she wanted it? And this is, I don't know if you guys have seen it, but there is a film called, a TV show for HBO called I May Destroy You.
No, I've not seen that yet, but I really want to. Created
by Michaela Cole, and it's fucking incredible. And there's so many parallels with this film. Michaela Cole's character in I May Destroy You, she's raped right at the beginning of the first episode. And it kind of goes on with how she's dealing with the trauma. But in the last episode, she writes into the final episode three different scenarios. And the first scenario she writes into the episode is basically what happens in this, in a sense, is that she acts drunk and then drugs this guy. She oversteps the mark. The guy ends up dying. The next one, she's roofied, and then she takes loads of cocaine to counteract the roofies, and then she tries to, you know, tell her rapist what he'd done wrong, in a maybe more of a cathartic type sense. And then you're given a third option where she tries to take control of her own life and doesn't approach him, and instead kind of, I don't know, maybe tries to deal with it in a different way. And I think what that does in that TV show is, I suppose, it has the luxury of giving you those three different scenarios so that you can maybe understand the thought process of a victim of sexual abuse. Whereas I guess in this, you've got it. I wouldn't go as far to say it's single-minded, because, no, you know, it ultimately, at the end of the day, it's a feminist revenge thriller. So there is going to be vengeance. There is going to be, you know, kind of a comeuppance in the end, I suppose. We are pushed for time. I know we are, guys. So let's actually move on to the final, the final revelation. I suppose the video of Cassie's friend Nina is revealed, and it shows Al Munro and his friends, Al Munro raping Nina, and Ryan, her boyfriend, is also there, not involved, but he's there nonetheless, watching and not doing anything about what's happening, which I guess pushes Cassie over the edge in a way. She then decides to go to Al Munro's bachelor party, dressed in a nurse outfit, because obviously they went to med school. And what follows is, I guess it's important. You know, she finally speaks about Nina, you know, quite honestly, actually, as she's handcuffed Al Munro to the bed, and she speaks about Nina and what she meant to her, how she, you know, was basically, she couldn't believe that Nina would let me be her friend. And I guess she idolized this girl. There's a line she says, which is really quite powerful when she's talking about Nina. She says, she was, yeah, again, I am paraphrasing, but it's basically, you know, she was Nina until she wasn't.
Yeah.
You know, and then she says that his name was all over her and she wants to put her name all over him, which is a ballsy move to whack out a knife and get ready to kind of carve Nina's name into Al Monroe. And then obviously what happens is he breaks out of the handcuffs, and I can only say it was one of the most harrowing and quite uncomfortable couple of minutes on film that I've watched probably ever. She's basically suffocated, and I know that Emerald Fennell spoke about, they actually spoke to experts and they wanted to convey on camera how long it would take for someone, you know, of Carey Mulligan's size to die of suffocation. So they did that. And Carey Mulligan actually, there was no stunt double. She actually did that. She was there in that scene. That was her. And she actually even had to do the, what's the word called, Connor, when you do the audio off screen?
What, you just had to do like the pickups essentially?
Yeah. She had to do the screams, pick up screams, because obviously they couldn't pick it up on camera. Mm-hmm. When you think about that as a whole, even, you know, literally Carey Mulligan performing that and then having to do the pickups afterwards, I mean, I think it's like that in itself is powerful. But then what you actually see on screen, it's, you know, with the squirming and like the screaming. And yeah, some might argue that Cassie doesn't want, some might argue that Cassie ultimately wanted to die. Maybe she thought there was no meaning left in her life, so she just wanted to have this one final act of getting these guys. But as she's being suffocated, she is struggling and she's trying to get out. So I guess in a sense, she is also fighting for her life. What did we make of this moment? And, you know, subsequently she is burnt as well. Luke, what did you make of this?
It's, I think Connor said he, the last bit, so let's say 5-10 minutes, this bit basically was like a little bit confusing and all, like the way it ties itself up. I thought it was absolutely amazing, you know, and like, not, I think if it had been a film that had been a straight up horror, it might not have felt that amazing. And when I say amazing, like, it was, you're right, Liam, like, it was well more shocking than anything you've seen in these horrors that I thought this film was going to be. Because, like, you go into it and you expect it, and that's what it is, I suppose. But, like, there's something about someone gets stabbed, and you see people in horror movies get stabbed every other fucking week. There's something about the suffocation that is really horrible, like, really horrible and quite disturbing. But I thought the choices, I didn't think they were that bad. I didn't expect them at all. I didn't expect. But then when you look back at it, well, where would the how would you be able to end the film? Like, where would the film end? Like, it was, because it, I suppose the whole idea of the story up to the point when she suffocated, and then when afterwards, when the two lads are talking, they say, like, don't worry about it, we'll sort this, we'll figure it out. Which, by the way, his friend is another nice guy from New Girl, so it all kind of ties in, doesn't it? Yeah. So, but I thought, yeah, I did think it was shocking, but I just thought it was really. I think it hammered the point home a little bit, especially when he comes in and goes, we'll tell no one, don't worry about it. Like, it was an accident, wasn't it? And then he's like, because obviously the fella's really, like, shook up. And then his friend just says, don't worry, we'll sort it. It didn't happen, you know, it was an accident. She, you know, whatever. I can't remember what she exactly said. It was probably a lot more horrific than that. And at that point, it just, you were kind of just going, like, fucking hell. Like, this was obviously going to happen because this film, and they were obviously going to get away with it, and then they didn't, and that was a bit confusing. But I still thought it was, like, I think I thought to myself, just kind of like, that's kick ass. I just love the fact that that's just happened. Mm-hmm. And like, it doesn't make sense in a way that, like, the film goes in one direction and it almost departs from what it is by having them be caught. But I didn't think that was bad. I still thought that was really good, but maybe just it wasn't, as Connor said, like, it it broke character just not even a load, just slightly maybe. And that's kind of, but when I say it was awesome, I purely mean in terms of like decisions and like maybe not the acting, because maybe the acting, I don't know, just the whole thing of it. I just thought like, fucking hell, I didn't expect that to happen. And I love it when I don't expect things to happen in films.
You know, what's really interesting is I, hearing that, I fully get it. Like, I get why it was, it clicked with you specifically and why you enjoyed it. The only real thing that I wasn't in the fan of was the fact that it turns out actually the police did come and arrest the guys that did it. And there's so many comments that you could, or there's so many things that could be the reason why this is how it ended. There's so many things that you could look to and be like, oh, maybe it's because it actually took the death of two women. Another woman had to die for this, for the police to finally get involved and finally be able to, for the system to actually take notice of the crimes that were committed. Maybe you could argue that, but it's never really made clear. And there's a lot of, I don't know, there's kind of the whole, for me anyway, her whole MO, her whole mission statement was having to take this matter into her own hands and get this revenge. And obviously the self-destructive, self-cannibalizing nature of revenge means that you're probably going to go down with the ship as well. So that when it all kind of played out that she had this backup plan, that even if she did die, the police would still come in and pick her up. I was kind of like, well, what was that about then? You know? And I get that it does work. And it reminded me a little bit of, you know, it's a weird parallel, obviously, but it kind of gives me a little bit of Get Out vibes, where the original ending was that the police were going to show up and not his friend Rod from the TA in a police car. And that when he looks up and sees the police car, you know immediately he's fucked.
Well, originally the ending was going to be, it was just going to end on her death and her being burned. It was just going to end.
And the necklace. I think that would have been like jaw-dropping, holy fuck.
Yeah,
and
but
the kind of cop-out end. Not cop-out is horrible.
I think you've also got to think with that is, you know, at the end of the day, it is a film that is, I guess it is, it's depicted as a black comedy revenge thriller. So I think you've got to have that revenge kind of come full circle by the end. Otherwise, I think it's too black. I think if you have her this dead at the end being burnt.
Yeah, look, I see that too.
That's far too harrowing. But to be fair, there's a piece for Slate.com by Dana Stevens. She actually chats a lot about how in this film the justice system is depicted as like a failure, I guess, throughout most of the film. But then at the end, you've got the cops to come and save the day.
Yeah, that's exactly why I was like, what the fuck?
For me, I didn't like that aspect of it. I didn't think it worked. I don't know what would have worked instead for her to get her vengeance. Mm-hmm. I mean, I know there are a lot of people who wished she hadn't have died. You know, there are, you know, pieces that I've read by women who say that it makes it feel worthless, you know, and it makes almost other victims of sexual assault feel like there isn't an out or an escape route. Wow. Because ultimately, you know, it's going to end in death, the death of two women, just to convict a guy who may or may not go down. You know, there's a video showing something that he did 10 years ago. How's that going to hold up in court? You know, there's so many questions that I think underlie and undercut what is overall a really good, clever, brilliantly shocking film. But I think that one aspect of it for me maybe takes away, because you have to think ultimately with rape and sexual assault in the UK, especially, I don't know about the US, but the percentage of convictions is minuscule, absolutely minuscule. So to have that element in this film, I think completely takes away from the ultimate goal of this film, which I guess is exposure and is to shed a light on rape culture and what actually happens a lot. And I don't know, maybe it was purposeful for us to at the end sit here and think, oh, well, they're not going to get convicted anyway. But then I think that makes Cassie, I think that makes Carey Mulligan's character look not as bright, not as clever for her to be that naive to trust the police.
There's
some blurred lines with the ending, I guess, on how you will, I guess, take it. I don't know if we have any more points to add on this film. I know we're cut for time. Any other business, folks? All right, so we'll give our popcorns then. Luke, I'll throw it to you first, mate.
I'm going to give it an 81 on first watch.
Connor?
I think, you know what? I'm kind of down a little bit on it, but there's so much I like, especially the multiple callbacks to The Night of the Hunter, which is a film I fucking adore. So I'm going to give it 73.
I'm going to give it my popcorns from my first watch, which would be 75. But then if you were to ask me again, you know, because obviously you would, I'd say 85 after my second watch. It lands a lot better and I can deal with the ending a lot better after the second watch, is my opinion.
Can I just make one slight point? It's not even really a point, really. I love it when films become like a bit of a cultural thing. Mm-hmm. Like there's something happening, and it probably didn't help that it wasn't like released in cinemas or it was during like the COVID 12 months. But like, I just love it when there's like a bit of a buzz about a film. So obviously this film is quite controversial, just, you know, because it is like not many films come out like this. And I just love it when shit like that happens. And like, you know, people were talking about it and people are going, oh, this is sick. And people are saying like, oh, have you seen this film? And like, it gets all quite buzzy. And I just fucking love it when that happens. And that's all I wanted to say.
It's been over a year now since it premiered at Sundance. So it's, you know, it's been riding away for a long time. Very similar to Get Out when that was released as well. That was released quite early on in the year and it rode a massive tidal wave, quite cultural tidal wave until it was nominated for Oscars the next year. Same with Promising Young Woman again. So yeah, that is really impressive, isn't it? So next week, we don't know what we're doing next week, but we're going to try and get a guest on. Which means we could be doing something that we've all seen before. Hopefully it's something good. Hopefully it's Avengers Endgame.
How did we manage to get it back in the podcast? This is a record.
On that note, please follow us on Instagram and Twitter at First Take Pod. We'd much appreciate any suggestions you have. As we said earlier, Promising Young Woman was suggested to us by a listener. So yeah, we do appreciate any kind of contact that you'd like to have with us in our DMs. They are open, aren't they, boys? They are very Always. Much open. Always. On that note, thanks very much for listening. We hope you've enjoyed this as much as we have. And on that note, we would just like to say goodbye for now.